Namaste. We move now into chapter 22, Vijnana or Gnosis. This was published as an essay in the Arya on 15 September 1917, about halfway through all of his work in the publication of that journal. The first article was The Life Divine, and the title of that was From the Undivine to the Divine, and then essays on the Gita followed with The Principle of Divine Works, and then this chapter on Vijnana. Again, Sri Aurobindo greatly improved this chapter around 1932. It never saw publication, but he was intent on restructuring his early sight in a larger vision, including but improving, expanding, deepening. So we have a much improved thesis here about Vijnana, which we can say off at the beginning that if jnana means knowledge, essential spiritual knowledge of the truth of being, Vijnana would mean the distribution of that truth. It is a level of consciousness, as we shall see, by the very significance of its suggestion, that begins in the ground of reality, but projects forth and withdraws into. So it's capable of all movements, it's capable of cosmicity, at the same time it is capable of retaining essentiality. The term Vijnana, as we see it in the Upanishads, is featured in all the Upanishads that mention it, like the Brihadaranyaka, the Chandogya, and of course the Taittiriya, as stationed above the mind. So there is a suprarational awareness that sages know can be attained. It is a different usage than we see in Buddhist psychology and philosophy, which restricts the term Vijnana to the functioning of the mind stuff. So when you see it in a Buddhist context, it's going to be quite different in its suggestion from what you see in a Brahmanical context. So, gnosis, of course, is a Greek word which refers to a true knowledge, a deep, insightful knowledge. So, we'll begin our chapter. Chapter 22, Vijnana or Gnosis. In our perfect self-transcendence, we pass out and up from the ignorance or half-enlightenment of our mental conscious being into a greater wisdom self and truth power above it, there to dwell in the unwalled light of a divine knowledge. The mental man that we are is changed into the Gnostic soul, the truth conscious Godhead, the Vijnanamaya Purusha. So Vijnanamaya means the Purusha who is made of Vijnana. So again, a direct reference, if we're looking for one in the Upanishads, to the Taittiriya Upanishad in the Bhrigu Valley, the third chapter, the tenth section, the fifth verse. Seated on that level of the hill of our ascension. We are in a quite different plane from this material, this vital, this mental poise of the universal spirit. And with this change, changes too all our view and experience of our soul life and of the world around us. We are born into a new soul status and put on a new nature. For according to the status of the soul is the status of the Prakriti. Purusha and Prakriti, brought into our conspectus again. The relationship between soul and nature is what establishes the reality of all these planes on the world stair. All these steps are a discussion, an arrangement between the consciousness watching and the power of the consciousness doing. And so it is a free play, but once established, the relationship becomes veridical and forms not simply a plane of being, but worlds and statuses of being inside. So if we vault beyond this triple world, which is customary for us, living in the material, the vital, and the mental being, then we attain a new status of soul power, a new status of soul illumination, and then can not simply see from there, but also act from there. He continues, at each transition of the world ascent, from matter to life, from life to mind, from mind bound to free intelligence, as the latent, half-manifested, or already manifest soul rises to a higher and higher level of being, the nature also is elevated into a superior working, a wider consciousness, a vaster force, and an intenser or larger range and joy of existence. Now this should suggest to us again, Satchit Ananda in play, in dynamic expression. But the transition from the mind self to the knowledge self is the great and the decisive transition in the yoga. It is the shaking off of the last hold on us of the cosmic ignorance and our firm foundation in the truth of things, in a consciousness infinite and eternal and inviolable by obscurity, falsehood, suffering, or error. So this is the shift in consciousness that shifts the world reality. As he's talked about our nature elevated from soul status to soul status, from the basis in matter through the vital and into the mental. Let's recall that all of this is inclusive. Nothing is left behind as one moves up. When we reach this suprarational level, this region of consciousness above the head, we gain access to and express a power that integrates, enlivens, and releases from ignorance and obscurity the lower members. It isn't that just the station of our topmost consciousness in that affects release there for us, but that all of it, enchained to each other in ignorance, now becomes released in spiritual liberty. This is the transformative power of the supramental. This is the first summit which enters into the divine perfection, sadharmya, sadrishya. For all the rest only look up to it or catch some rays of its significance. So sadharmya means having the same law of being. And sadrishya means having the same likeness or form When you look at one, you look at the other, it's the same thing you see. The highest heights of mind, or of overmind, come still within the belt of a mitigated ignorance. They can refract a divine light, but not pass it on in undiminished power to our lower members. So he's writing in 1932, he's saying, this shall be my testament on Vijnana. And he speaks about overmind, which is where he is currently stationed in his awareness. This is the power that he is able to dwell in at will and presumably to act from. And he says that it's essentially not capable of passing on power undiminished. It is a mitigated ignorance. He can see that his sight is restricted. He can feel that his power is not absolute, and so he can deduce this is not supramental. However bright, however vast, cosmic it may be, but it does not change matter utterly. To the roots, into the inconscience, it doesn't find the supermind below matter. The supramental power should be able to reach there and grasp it. For as long as we are within the triple stratum of mind, life, and body, our active nature continues to work in the force of the ignorance, even when the soul and mind possesses something of the knowledge. So release from the bondage of ego and ignorance and sitting felicitously and permanently in the consciousness of the Atman does not empower the rest of the being to change. It remains largely as it was. And even if the soul were to reflect or to represent all the largeness of the knowledge in its mental consciousness, it would be unable to mobilize it rightly in force of action. The truth in its action might greatly increase, but it would still be pursued by a limitation, still condemned to a divisibility which would prevent it from working integrally in the power of the infinite. The power of a divinely illumined mind may be immense compared with ordinary powers, but it will still be subject to incapacity, and there can be no perfect correspondence between the force of the effect of will and the light of the idea which inspires it. And we know from all that he's written till now, we know what he's written in The Life Divine because we've read it together, that the conscious power, chit shakti, expressed in the supramental as knowledge will, is perfect in unity, perfect in effectivity, perfect in harmony. The infinite presence may be there in status, but the dynamis of the operations of nature still belongs to the lower prakriti, must follow its triple modes of working, and cannot give any adequate form to the greatness within it. This is the tragedy of ineffectivity, of the hiatus between ideal and effective will, of our constant incapacity to work out in living form and action the truth we feel in our inner consciousness that pursues all the aspiration of mind and life towards the divinity behind them. You can feel the poignance in his language here. This is something he feels deeply, not simply for his own sadhana, but it's an ache for the world. But the vijnana, or gnosis, is not only truth, but truth power. It is the very working of the infinite and divine nature. It is the divine knowledge one with the divine will in the force and delight of a spontaneous and luminous and inevitable self-fulfillment. By the gnosis, then, we change our human into a divine nature. What, then, is this gnosis, and how can we describe it? Two opposite errors have to be avoided. Two misconceptions that disfigure opposite sides of the truth of gnosis. One error of intellect-bounded thinkers takes vijnana as synonymous with the other Indian term buddhi, and buddhi as synonymous with the reason, the discerning intellect, the logical intelligence. And as we noted before, after these early Upanishads that are our favorites, we find this term often used in just such parlance by Buddhist philosophers. The systems that accept this significance pass at once from a plane of pure intellect to a plane of pure spirit. No intermediate power is recognized, no diviner action of knowledge than the pure reason is admitted. The limited human means for fixing truth is taken for the highest possible dynamics of consciousness, its topmost force and original movement. An opposite error, a misconception of the mystics, identifies vijnana with the consciousness of the infinite, free from all ideation, or else ideation packed into one essence of thought, lost to other dynamic action in the single and invariable idea of the One. This is the Chaitanya-gana of the Upanishad and is one movement, or rather one thread, of the many-aspected movement of the gnosis. The gnosis, the vijnana, is not only this concentrated consciousness of the infinite essence, it is also, and at the same time, an infinite knowledge of the myriad play of the infinite. This might be a good point to mention that, again, it's curious, Sri Aurobindo never had the chance, so far as we know, to hold in his lap the treasury of the Trika, philosophy from Kashmir. Because in the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra, in the work of Abhinava Gupta, we see this term Vijnana used outside the Vedanta that we typically associate with Shankara and the Advaita school in a way that represents the Supreme Consciousness. That's what Vijnana means there. Vijnana Bhairava, this massive distributive consciousness, supreme consciousness of the divine. Bhairava, yes, is a reference to Shiva, but it is a status of divine being, conscious being, in which there is the whole of the essence. There is a push outward to project into the universe the powers of being that dwell infinitely within the One. But then to establish roots of return, R-O-U-T-E-S, so there are avenues that come back and there can be a reversal. So there is, if you will, an ascent and a descent possible to the yogin who reaches completion of the yoga as described in the Trika philosophy. So similar to Sri Aurobindo's in so many ways, and yet unknown to him. So, the gnosis, the vijnana, is not only this concentrated consciousness of the infinite essence, it is also and at the same time an infinite knowledge of the myriad play of the infinite. The one sounds like the other, does it not? It contains all ideation, not mental, but supramental. But it is not limited by ideation, for it far exceeds all ideative movement. Nor is the Gnostic ideation in its character an intellectual thinking. It is not what we call the reason, not a concentrated intelligence. For the reason is mental in its methods, mental in its acquisitions, mental in its basis, but the ideative method of the gnosis is self-luminous, supramental. Its yield of thought light, spontaneous, not proceeding by acquisition. Its thought basis, a rendering of conscious identities, not a translation of the impressions born of indirect contacts. Remembering Sri Aurobindo's preference to knowledge by identity over knowledge by indirection. That is truth, and the other only a partial truth. There is a relation, and even a sort of broken identity, between the two forms of thought. For one proceeds covertly from the other. Mind is born from that which is beyond mind. But they act on different planes and reverse each other's process. Mind derived from the supermind with a reversal of process. Even the purest reason, the most luminous rational intellectuality, is not the gnosis. Aha, warning to philosophers. Reason or intellect is only the lower buddhi. Remember, he's differentiated between a higher buddhi, which seems like it's going to lead into intuition, and this lower buddhi, which is the supremacy of mind at its peak, where you get a Kant, where you get a Fichte. There is indeed a higher form of the buddhi that can be called the intuitive mind or intuitive reason, the mind made intuitive. And this, by its intuitions, its inspirations, its swift revelatory vision, its luminous insight and discrimination, can do the work of the reason with a higher power, a swifter action, a greater and spontaneous certitude. It acts in a self-light of the truth, which does not depend upon the torch flares of the sense mind and its limited, uncertain percepts. It proceeds not by intelligent, but by visional concepts. It is a kind of truth vision, truth hearing, truth memory, direct truth discernment. This true and authentic intuition must be distinguished from a power of the ordinary mental reason, which is too easily confused with it, the power of involved reasoning that reaches its conclusion by a bound and does not need the ordinary steps of the logical mind. The logical reason proceeds pace after pace and tries the sureness of each step like a man who is walking over unsafe ground and has to test by the hesitating touch of his foot each span of soil that he perceives with his eye. But this other supralogical process of the reason is a motion of rapid insight or swift discernment. It proceeds by a stride or leap, like a man who springs from one sure spot to another point of sure footing, or at least held by him to be sure. He sees the space he covers in one compact and flashing view, but he does not distinguish or measure either by eye or touch its successions, features, and circumstances. This movement has something of the sense of power of the intuition, something of its velocity, some appearance of its light and certainty, and we are always are apt to take it for the intuition. But our assumption is an error, and if we trust to it, may lead us into grievous blunders. So here's the moment to exercise viveka, discrimination, and see between the two. It is even thought by the intellectualists that the intuition itself is nothing more than this rapid process in which the whole action of the logical mind is swiftly done, or perhaps half consciously or subconsciously done, not deliberately worked out in its reasoned method. Okay, a word about intuition as it appears in the annals of philosophy, I guess. So intuition, in Latin, from in, I-N, and tueri, and it means to look at. What it refers to is a direct insight into truth. Yes, philosophy recognizes the possibility of seeing directly what is true without having to go through a rational process. Spinoza used the term scientia intuitiva, describing a mode of thinking that rises and lives under the aspect of eternity. So a kind of thought that sublimates itself, that reaches into the ground of being of God. And that consciousness, interestingly in Spinoza, doesn't divorce you from the other two modes of intuition, which would be the empirical, where you can figure out what's going on instantly, your hand knows what to touch, etc., or the rational, because intuition can play in the light of the mind as well. This is a power of consciousness above, and it's non-propositional. It doesn't begin with a premise and follow a logical train. It is something mystical. You may also know that Albert Einstein, when he was a young teenager, read deeply and with tremendous enthusiasm all the works of Spinoza, another Jewish philosopher who saw God in nature and nature in God. Natura naturanta, natura naturans. Nature naturing and nature natured. And they were both the same being. It wasn't pantheism, because he certainly had a more interesting view than simply that the divine is the universe. He recognized that there was a divine beyond the universe. But philosophers, to be brief, have dealt with him unfairly. Spinoza, intuition. Back to Sri Aurobindo. In its nature, however, this proceeding is quite different from the intuition, and it is not necessarily a truth movement. The power of its leap may end in a stumble. Its swiftness may betray. Its certainty is too often a confident error. The validity of its conclusions must always depend on a subsequent verification or support from the evidence of the sense perceptions, or a rational linking of intelligent conceptions must intervene to explain to it its own certitudes. This is how the mind works. This lower light may indeed receive very readily a mixture of actual intuition into it, and then a pseudo-intuitive or half-intuitive mind is created, very misleading by its frequent luminous successes, palliating a whirl of intensely self-assured false certitudes. The true intuition, on the contrary, carries in itself its own guarantee of truth. It is sure and infallible within its limits. And so long as it is pure intuition and does not admit into itself any mixture or of sense error or intellectual ideation, it is never contradicted by experience. The intuition may be verified by the reason or the sense perception afterwards, but its truth does not depend on that verification. It is assured by an automatic self-evidence. You may remember when, during his lifetime, Einstein's theories were challenged. They were held to be invalid. There was no proof. There seemed to be proof in fact to contradict his theories, and he stuck to his intuition. This had been something revelatory to him, that which stemmed from a cosmic religious feeling, as he described it. He was not a worshiper of God, but he felt something Spinozan, if you will, in the nature, the very nature of the world. And he said, no, this will be reversed. This is too good a vision not to be true. And he was vindicated. And the main elements of his thinking continue to this day. By the way, Spinoza was first Baruch Spinoza, the blessed Jewish, because he had a falling out with the rabbinate of the day. He took the name Benedict, which means the same thing. Not that he ever attended Catholic Church, but worked freely on his own theories beyond theistic religion of any kind. Einstein also was free of theistic religion. Pardon the editorial. If the reason, depending on its inferences, contradicts the greater light, it will be found in the end on ampler knowledge that the intuitional conclusion was correct and that the more plausible, rational, and inferential conclusion was an error. For the true intuition proceeds from the self-existent truth of things and is secured by that self-existent truth, and not by any indirect, derivatory, or dependent method of arriving at knowledge. Self-existent truth shines of its own light and that light is itself reality. This is a great place, I think, to put a bookmark. I think we'll take 3 weeks to complete our chapter, a few pages at a time. But if you permit, here's a section from Savitri. This moves to Book 10, The Book of the Devil, Twilight, Canto 4, The Dream Twilight of the Earthly Real. This is on page 659. A few have dared the last supreme ascent, and break through borders of blinding light above, and feel a breath around of mightier air, receive a vaster being's messages, and bathe in its immense intuitive ray. On summit mind are radiant altitudes, exposed to the luster of infinity, outskirts and dependencies of the house of truth, upraised estates of mind and measureless. There man can visit, but there he cannot live. A cosmic thought spreads out its vastitudes. Its smallest parts are here philosophies, challenging with their detailed immensity, each figuring an omniscient scheme of things. But higher still can climb the ascending light. There are vasts of vision and eternal suns, oceans of an immortal luminousness, flame hills assaulting heaven with their peaks. There, dwelling, all becomes a blaze of sight. A burning head of vision leads the mind. Thought trails behind it its long comet tail. The heart glows, an illuminate and seer, and sense is kindled into identity. A highest flight climbs to a deepest view. In a wide opening of its native sky, intuition's lightnings range in a bright pack, hunting all hidden truths out of their lairs. Its fiery edge of seeing absolute cleaves into locked, unknown retreats of self, rummages the sky recesses of the brain, lights up the occult chambers of the heart. Its spear point ictus of discovery, pressed on the cover of name, the screen of form, strips bare the secret soul of all that is. Thought there has revelation's sunbright eyes. The word, a mighty and inspiring voice, enters truth's inmost cabin of privacy and tears away the veil from God and life. Then stretches the boundless finite's last expanse, the cosmic empire of the overmind, time's buffer state bordering eternity, too vast for the experience of man's soul. All here gathers beneath one golden sky. The powers that build the cosmos station take in its house of infinite possibility. Each god from there builds his own nature's world. Ideas are phalanxed like a group of suns, each marshaling his company of rays. Thought crowds in masses seized by one regard. All time is one body, space a single look. There is the Godhead's universal gaze, and there the boundaries of immortal mind. The line that parts and joins the hemispheres closes in on the labor of the gods, fencing eternity from the toil of time. Namaste, Jai Ma.